Welcome to In the Room. It's the Connecticut Mirror's monthly series of unconventional conversations with state leaders. I'm John Dankosky with the Connecticut Mirror, amongst other places. And I'd like to thank a bunch of people for making this possible. First of all, the Mohegan Tribe. Thank you very much for playing host. A nice round of applause for the folks at Mohegan. But also, of course, the Connecticut Business and Industry Association, Eversource, Clifton, Larson, Allen, the Causeway Agency, Express Strategies, Hinckley Allen, and Rothorn Law. I will be asking some questions that some of you sent in advance, and we'll get to as many of those as we can. But first of all, I'd just like to welcome Governor Lamont. It's great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us for this.
John, great to be back. Love to be here with the Mirror. They do great work.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think the last time I talked to you in person, my beard wasn't as white, but I know your hair wasn't as gray. You've talked about this a little bit. Did you make a decision to go gray? Or is this like an Obama thing where, you know, the job is just worn on you over the years?
I'm going to be a grandfather in 5 weeks.
That's
awesome. I think life marches on. God willing, a little boy named Finn. So time will tell.
Excellent. So this is the grandfather look. How does it feel? This is the first time you're going to be a grandfather. How does it feel?
I love it. I love seeing my wife is so happy. My daughter is so happy. I'm so happy. Gives you a little different perspective on life, too, doesn't it? I mean, you're not thinking about 2 years or 4 years out. You're thinking long term. I want to make sure that this is a place where Finn can call home. It feels really good as well.
That is interesting. I mean, I guess if you're in politics, a lot of times people are thinking kind of short term. They're thinking about the next election cycle. If you're in the state legislature, you're thinking 2 years, 2 years, 2 years. But does having grandkids actually make you think about, you know, 50 or 100 years? Have you considered what the state's going to be like then?
Well, I certainly think about what the state's going to be like then. I mean, generally speaking, everybody in the political world is thinking short-term. One thing a governor's got to do is say, what's the state going to look like in 2035? And, you know, when I'm trying to tell people why this is an amazing state, why you want to move to the state, why you want to expand your business in the state, you got to be able to tell a story about what it's going to be. And I did that in my business life, and I do that today. And sort of the governor, that's their job, a cheerleader for the state. Been a lot easier, I got to say, over the last little bit. We've had, five, six balanced budgets in a row. We've been able to cut taxes, and the UConn Huskies keep winning. So that makes my life a little easier.
Yeah, as long as the basketball team keeps winning, everybody loves everything about the state. A lot has changed since you've become governor, but I'd like to ask you about how you think you're different than the person I first met back in 2006 when you were running against Joe Lieberman. Like, what is fundamentally different about you, Ned?
I was the former third selectman of Greenwich when I took on former candidate for Vice President of the United States, Senator Lieberman, because I had a fundamental disagreement. I thought that the invasion of Iraq was a terrible decision for our country and world peace, and we went at it and had a pretty good battle. And that was a real emotional push for me. And I was telling John, ironically, 2 weeks ago, as you know, Senator Lieberman passed away, and he asked me to speak at his memorial service. And I was never so moved. As I pointed out, everybody else went back to Senator Lieberman 50 years and a very different. I said we had a less auspicious start to our relationship, but I was proud to do it. Governor's a very different job. Frankly, I think I like governor more. The idea of going down to Washington and taking orders from Mitch McConnell or Chuck Schumer probably wouldn't have really floated my boat. And governor, you're sort of the chief executive. You're the cheerleader for the state. You've got to manage, and you got to tell a story about what this state's going to be like in 10 and 20 years and why you want to be here and be invested in this state.
But like, how are you different? Like, what about you has changed in that time?
I think one thing I've learned as governor is maybe you come in and you say, here's the cost-benefit analysis, this is why we ought to do it this way. And then you realize, slow down. It's not so much, remember what FDR used to say? People don't care what you know until they know that you care. And I found, especially in politics and especially in the legislature, especially in the Capitol, it's really important to listen to people, know where they're coming from, know how their kid is doing. And you start with that before you get into where you want to go. And I think those relationships have been very good. On Republican and Democratic side, we have a pretty good working relationship with the legislature, and that helps a lot.
Yeah, it must help a lot. What did you think about the job going in that you just got completely wrong? That now that you've been in the job for a while, you're like, oh, yeah, I didn't get that at all. Now I know what the job actually is.
I think I was probably a little skeptical about the state employees and that they were, you know, I come out of the business world and maybe they were looking to retire early and do something else, and I was dead wrong. We have great state employees. If you care about the environment, if you care about transportation, you care about education, the best and the brightest want to go into state government. Washington's good, don't get me wrong, you can write good policy briefs, but in state government, that's where the rubber meets the road and you can make a real difference. I've been very impressed with the people I have the great honor to work with in state government. Legislators, I'm still figuring out. I have a 15-year perspective and they maybe have the next election. But we worked that through together pretty well.
As you look back, is there something that you wish you would have done better in this job so far?
Well, the first big hit we had, obviously, was COVID. And I wish I'd done everything earlier. You know, I waited for those masks to come up from the stockpile down in Washington, D.C., where there was no stockpile, there were no masks, and, you know, that extra month, you know, cost us a little bit. I think hindsight is 20/20 there. I think when I came into legislature that first year, I knew exactly where I wanted to go. I thought this was a state that was going backwards, and people were leaving the state, and moving vans were going, and companies were going, and we had a deficit upon deficit. I think I had to spend a little more time listening and a little less time talking that first year.
That's interesting. I mean, that's something I think that politicians just don't learn that. I think everyone learns that, right? Isn't that, that's maybe just a function of getting older, though. We should all probably talk less and listen more, don't you think?
I think that's especially true in politics. I mean, if you want to see what people's objections are, don't just listen to what they say, but listen to how they say it, where they're coming from. And then you can find there often is middle ground, and you can see how you can get the yes. Getting the yes is not easy in politics. There are 100 ways to get the no. There's one way to get the yes. We've been pretty good at getting the yes the last 5 years.
See, since you actually brought up, you know, the things you say, the way that you say them, I actually wanted to ask you about word usage. This is something you and I used to talk about a lot when you were on the radio show a lot with me. So during the primary elections, there was a campaign to cast votes for uncommitted in the Democratic primary. It was people trying to signify some displeasure with the Biden administration for support of Israel in the conflict in Gaza. You were asked about that campaign, and you said that these people were wasting their vote, they were wasting your time, and that, quote, the hottest place in hell is reserved for those who stay neutral. So my question,
I think Dante said that actually, but I just misquoted him.
You misquoted him. Is that exactly what you meant to say? That you essentially are condemning people to hell for their political beliefs?
I think it was a little more figurative than that, John. But I suppose, look, we can have 10 different candidates, and each appeals to me in a different way, and I'm going to let the perfect be the enemy of the good, but I think at the end of the day, in our democracy is well served. We have our candidates. You line up behind them. You try and make them better as best you can. I have, you know, some opportunity to do that in the job I've got. And I think the idea that 30, 40, 50% of the people sit on their sidelines and say, I'm not going to get involved because I don't like the candidates. I don't like that. I want people involved. I want them to have a stake in the outcome. I care very much about people turning out and voting here in Connecticut. And then when the election's over, whether you voted for me, against me, you know, they have a stake in the outcome, and I get a chance to work with them.
But these people were actually literally saying, I mean, these are Democrats. These are people who would like to support Joe Biden, but they were literally saying, I'm trying to send a message to someone who I want to support, but I can't because of this one thing. That feels entirely different than sitting it out on the sidelines.
Hey, look, If you want to sit out in the and have a protest vote during the Connecticut primary, which is not that meaningful a primary, I was being a little facetious. I think when push comes to shove and you have a race between Donald Trump and Joe Biden sitting on the sidelines as a way of casting a vote that may be antithetical to what you really want to do.
Oh. How do you choose the things that you're going to say when you want to influence people to vote a certain way, or you want to influence people on an issue? I mean, you impressed me when I first met you as someone who just kind of said what was on his mind. And I'm wondering how you think about what you say in politics.
Well, Julie and my comms team would say I don't think about it enough before I say it.
it may be possible that your people think that, but what do you think about it?
But I think, look, here's what I really think. Yeah. I believe that in this day and age, people want to know who you are and why you believe what you believe. Uh-huh. And too many people and politicians say, I'm going to do it this way. I want you to do this. I want you to do that. And I found during COVID, that doesn't work. You have to say, this is why I think we should be doing it the way we're proposing. You got to think out loud sometimes with people. And don't be shy if sometimes you have to change your mind. And I think I do that, and I think it serves me well. People have a sense of where I'm coming from. Even when I get it wrong, they have a sense of where I was coming from.
How do you make decisions on the job on a daily basis?
I talk to the widest variety of people. I've got Republicans and Democrats and everybody in the administration. They come in, we go back and forth, and then I've got to decide. There's only one, you got to decide, and then we all row in the same direction.
But
during COVID, that
yeah.
was really tough. I had half the people say, put on a hazmat suit, stay home. Anything less than that, you're endangering yeah. my family. I had the other half of the folks saying, if I can't keep my economy going and my kids getting back to school, our society as we know it's going to be over. And mm-hmm. every day you had to make a decision. I had the best people in the world never agreeing. The governor's got to make up their mind.
For the most part, are they bringing you papers to read? Or are they sitting down in your office and arguing things out? Are they coming to you and saying, Governor, I think you need to do it this way, and there's somebody next to them saying, you need to do it that way? Like, walk me through exactly how it works for people who aren't in the room.
I'm not a big paper guy. I read numbers just because I think they tell a story in a very finite way. But I love to hear people come in and express their point of view on different topics. And I internalize that a lot better. I listen to it. And that can be folks in my administration. That can be commissioners. That can be advocates. That can be labor. That can be business. And then, like I said, there's really only, then I got to make up my mind. And then I make up my mind, then I got to sit down with the legislative leaders and see if I can lead them along or not. And often you have to compromise to make a deal. That's the nature of our system.
I think in that you mentioned a lot of people who are obviously going to get close to the governor. These people in the legislature, people who are in your administration. Do you remember times when you just met folks shaking hands at a place like Mohegan Sun? And somebody really changed your mind about something, a person who just voted for you, or maybe somebody who didn't vote for you, who just came up and said, yeah, this is something you should think about, Governor. You're like, you know what? You're probably right. I was doing that wrong.
I think I thought that coming out of COVID, I was really worried about learning loss, and I wanted to get summer schools going and get our kids back learning so that they'd be ready to hit the ground running. And I talked to parents, and I talked to some kids, and they were not ready for that. Their kids needed a shoulder to lean on. I didn't realize how scarring that was for many of the young people. And their stories really resonated in me. And we ended up having fun summer learning camps. I call them learning just to make me feel better, but and access to all the museums and just ways that they could be together. And if they were learning, it was fun learning, not rote learning. And now it's, 3+ years later, and there's still some of those scars, and I still hear that from some of these kids.
That's a good one. That's interesting. We got a lot of questions from our members in advance. And I'm going to get to some of them now throughout the course of the rest of our conversation. And let me read one for you here. It starts like this. The social safety net is frayed. Low Medicaid rates for behavioral health and the funding for nonprofit service providers. People are realizing that the fiscal guardrails are handcuffing our ability to address these issues. Are you willing to explore alternatives and flexibility about these guardrails, or are you committed to them no matter what the detrimental effect is on some of Connecticut's most vulnerable residents? So it's your first question about the fiscal guardrails, but it comes from someone who's very concerned about what it means to people.
Let me just pull the lens back for a second. That just means I'm committed to an honestly balanced budget. And this state did not have an honestly balanced budget for 30 years. We paid a terrible price for that. And we lurched from deficit to deficit, and raised taxes and another deficit. And to your bigger point, during those 20 years, during the start of this century, we did not keep pace in terms of our social services, and they fell behind. This last 6 years, not only have we had balanced budgets, but we've increased funding for our not-for-profits, increased funding for daycare, not 1 year, 2 years, but every year. Done that for UConn, done that for CSU. To your bigger point, John, not as much as most of the advocates want, but in a way that I can do it on a consistent basis going forward. That said, you know, I hear the stories from not-for-profits and the such. We're going to be able to do a little more in this next session to help out. But most importantly, I want to make sure that what I do for all the not-for-profits and social services this year, I can build on it next year. That's how you make progress.
And I think a lot of people who have been looking at the problems, have certainly been reading the Connecticut Mirror over the years and been reading about the terrible pension liability problems. The hole the state dug itself, it's something that we've been able to start to get out of. That having been said, also right now on the Connecticut Mirror is a headline report, billions more in taxes coming to Connecticut than expected. There's much more money coming into the state than we could have imagined a couple of years ago. And the question is, if there are needs, $400, $500 million in social service programs, some aid to the universities in higher education, why not take that money and make an investment in the people of Connecticut who need it?
A, we're making that investment. B, we're making an increasing investment every year. And C, more money is not always the answer. I mean, I have a little back and forth with UConn, you know, and we have probably one of the biggest state grants per student or per capita in the country going to the University of Connecticut. I'm proud of that. It's one of the best public universities in the country. And at the same time, their tuition continually goes up. So I do. I talk to other university presidents. I think the higher ed committee in the legislature should be doing this, but I do it. It's because it's not always a question of more, but it's a question of better. And I talk to Indiana, and I say, how come you have a much lower grant and your tuition's going down and ours is the opposite? They say, well, our professors teach more courses, or they have more students in the lectures, or we have buyouts for professors that have courses that are terribly unpopular and nobody goes to them. Or we only have 6 staff, not 12 staff for a professor. All I'm trying to say is simply spending more is not always the answer. I don't think we're shortchanging these institutions. I am pushing in the reform and providing the funding along the way.
But you started that by saying we're making those investments. So how are we making the investments? And putting the UConn aside, if we're talking about the social service safety net that our member was talking about, how exactly are we making those contributions that are needed? Are we taking money that we have in surplus and spending it directly? Or are we finding some convoluted way to spend that money that we're going to have to go find again next year?
No. There's no convoluted way. We're not playing any of these games. We have a relatively strong economy. We're one of the fastest growing. We are the fastest growing state in the Northeast. We were the opposite of that 7 or 8 years ago. We have many people moving into the state, not moving out of the state, tens of thousands of people. And a lot of them are paying taxes. We have a growing economic pie. That allows me to increase funding for CSU and daycare and not-for-profits, not as much as people want, but every year that I've been governor. And that contrasts dramatically with what happened for the previous 12 years. And that gets to everybody says we got to make up for what's happened in the last 20 years. We're making up for it every day. We've almost doubled spending for in our CSU system. We've got free workforce training. So every person that wants a job, I can get them a job right now. Doing everything I can to get people back in the game. Daycare has been a big expansion, very important to me. Is there more to do? Yeah. Oh.
It may not be convoluted to you. I was reading through some of the stories that my colleague Keith Faniff has been writing about this, and maybe I'm just not understanding this exactly, but it seems as though what we're doing is we're actually borrowing to make some of these investments instead of spending money that we have, which is constrained by the fiscal guardrails that we've put up. We're actually borrowing money against the ARPA funds that we have to spend in a certain time. This is the money that came in because of COVID, and we're spending money that way. Isn't that a little strange to be borrowing money to make these investments?
I have no idea what any of that means.
No, really?
No. I mean, we are borrowing money to invest in housing. We're having the biggest investment in affordable and supportive housing in the history of the state. Those are capital investments. They have long-term benefits, and I borrowed some money to do that. That's why we have a capital account. We are borrowing some money to rebuild our transportation system. All rail will be 15 minutes faster within the next 10 years. We are borrowing to do that. What I don't want to have happen is people use one-time federal money to pay for long-term operating expenses, because that federal money, John, does end in about
a
year, and then you have a cliff. So I'm very careful to say, use the last of our federal money very diligently to do one-time things that could make a difference. You know, fix that boiler. What I did in state government is I gave a lot of state employees a $3,500 bonus. I said, thank you for what you did during COVID. But it was not a long-term pay increase. It was a bonus.
Yeah. So, but back to these guardrails then. Is there, have you thought about the idea that within a year or so, probably some people in the legislature, I would guess not in an election year like it is now, will come back and say, look, Governor, we really need to reform this. We have money sitting on the sidelines that we could be investing in different ways in the state, in the people of Connecticut. Are you willing to look at these guardrails and maybe make some reforms?
There's no money sitting on the sidelines. I just don't know what that means. You can say, I'm paying down 2% of the unfunded pension liability this year. Uh-huh. This is a state that did not put a dime into pensions for the previous 40, 50 years and left us with this gaping hole that was really sapping the energy and optimism from the state. It was, and those pension costs were eating a bigger and bigger piece of our budget once we belatedly started to pay them. We've been doing a good job of paying down those pension costs. And you know what that means to the social services? It's freed up about $800 million a year that right now I'm earning interest on, or I don't have to pay the pension contributions, and that allows me to put that into daycare and other not-for-profits.
Okay, so this is something that you don't think needs to be revisited anytime in the near future?
We did revisit it. We revisited 1 year ago, and the legislature almost unanimously said, let's keep the guardrails going for five more years with an automatic renewal for another five if they elect to do that. I think it's the right thing to do. And Keith used to think it was the right thing to do.
Let's move to another member question. What is your plan to entice young people to stay in Connecticut?
I want this to be the most family-friendly state in the country. And what does that mean? That means we provide nurse support for all newborns. And we send people there. We're starting this off as a test in Bridgeport. Beyond that, we have the first paid family and medical leave on a statewide basis going down to one, making sure that that mom or dad can spend up to 12 weeks with their child when they get going. As I've said a couple times, we have the biggest expansion of daycare in the history of the state. What that means is making it easier for that mom or dad, and sadly, it's often a single parent. We used to have, 30% of our people live alone now in this state. That's a big change. So daycare is so important to help people get back. These are all ways that I like to make sure that people say we're a family-friendly state. That's why more of our graduates are staying, and that's why we have a lot of young people moving into the state for the first time in a long time.
What sort of economic development incentives do you think the state needs to be thinking about in the next 2, 3, 5 years? Are there ways in which Connecticut can start to move into some of these industries, like artificial intelligence, say, that other states are starting to innovate in and are going to be big drivers of jobs in the future?
I think the most important incentives I could do, what all my predecessors used to do is say, if you move to the state of Connecticut, I'll give your company a $40 million incentive. I've moved away from that. It was just turning into a competitive warfare with the other states and bidding up. I like to take care of the things we got to take care of. And that means I will do my best to make sure you have the best trained, most productive workforce and get you those people there. I will do everything I can to make sure they have housing so they know where they can live. I get them to and from work less expensively or faster. I've got a balanced budget so you don't have to worry about that, at least for the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, I think those are the ways that I incent. AI is your bigger question. AI is probably the most transformative thing that's happened in my life, and I've been around for a long time. And I want to make sure that Connecticut stays at the cutting edge, is at the front line there. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure we have the best trained people working with UConn and computer science to make sure that next generation has that opportunity. Startup monies for those new companies that want to get going. One of the things I'm going to do is put together a task force so that folks that have an idea how AI, which is artificial intelligence, can make an impact in state government, come to me so we can start working on that together.
It seems, you were talking about UConn, that will require investments in UConn, right? I mean, UConn will need to be a leader in that, We got to put money in.
No, UConn and Yale, one of the things I wanted to do was put together an AI quant hub down in the New Haven. What that means is how we can take AI and apply it to the life sciences, how you can do testing for new drugs and do that faster, more effectively, and more efficiently, how we can use artificial intelligence to speed up those processes, how we can personalize medicine. I want to do that in Connecticut because that's a place where we have an advantage. We have some of the best life sciences in the country, starting with UConn, starting with Yale University. That's how we would do it, and then they can build on the faculty and the such to expand from there.
Are you scared at all about artificial intelligence?
Terrified, but terrified because we don't exactly know where it can go. But too often in politics, people accent the negative, and they say, oh my God, artificial intelligence is all deep fake pornography and fake elections and spying. I think legitimate, but what's really important is what is the potential for AI and what can it do for education? What can that do for personalized medicine? Right now I go to my doctor and he says, I've always treated it this way, I'll treat it this way. AI is gonna make sure you have the best information so you can get the best personalized treatment. It's gonna be transformative. I'd give them a little room to run.
Do you think that states like Connecticut need to get out in front of some of the regulatory issues around this? Because that first list of things about deepfakes that so many people are concerned about, a lot of legislators are concerned about them. A lot of people in this room are concerned about them. Should we be putting some, I'll use the term again, guardrails around that?
I think we should. We may not have to because the Senate and the House are having bills right now that are doing the same thing. My instinct, John, is probably better to do AI on a national basis rather than have 50 states doing their own thing. But if we find the feds over the next year or two don't get it passed or there's some pushback, I'll work with all the other governors to see what we should do at the state level.
You trust the Senate and the House to do something about that, huh?
Well, I didn't say I trust them. I said right now they've got a bill, one of which is going to pass. You're right. I mean, Washington seems to be so dysfunctional right now, and the states are taking the lead. I think when it comes to AI, though, it's so early, I'm not sure we want to be the very first out of the box. You're going to inhibit a lot of innovation.
I had this conversation with Chris Murphy a couple weeks ago on stage, and we were actually talking about this, and I made the point that you and a lot of people think that Washington is dysfunctional. I said, no, Washington's not dysfunctional. We get stuff done every day. He's showing, he says, all the ways in which that works. Do you believe that the states are a better place to innovate than what they are able to do in Washington right now? Do you really think they're so dysfunctional?
Well, two different questions there. I think they are pretty dysfunctional. I think the House of Representatives is an embarrassment. I was shocked by lack of action on the Senate bill on immigration, shocked by how derelict they were when it came to Ukraine and what's going on in the Middle East, and they just can't make up their minds. That said, many issues, I think, are better handled at the national level. I think I would love to see the environment be done much more on a national. I'd like to see guns be limited more on a national level. I'd like to see AI regulated not by 50 independent states, but done on a national level. But if they're incapable of moving, then the states will be the laboratory of democracy.
We had another question from a member. This is about another tech issue. What are your thoughts about the proposed data center for Millstone Point, Waterford? Has anybody thought about what it's going to do to the environment, to wildlife, the energy grid, or property values? Wouldn't this be better off in an industrial area? What do you know about that project?
I know a little bit about that project. Here, I'll just speak out loud. There was a plan, a proposal to put a significant data center at Millstone, which is the nuclear power plant. What they want to do is put it at Millstone. It's always on carbon-free power right there. There's plenty of capacity for it. If you could make a case, if you want a data center, that's probably a very good place for it to be, John. And if you say, look, we're talking about AI and all the computing power you're going to need, why doesn't Connecticut want to be a leader when it comes to data centers? Then I can tell you that data center they proposed up there at Millstone will utilize more electricity than Bridgeport and Waterbury use combined right now.
This one data center?
One data center. And right now I have some extra capacity electricity, but electricity usage is going like that. So I've got to balance what that means in terms of technology in our future with the fact that I got to have an effective, reliable, affordable, green electricity system. They're in conflict.
But doesn't that limit our ability to bring in businesses just like that? We can't bring in a big data center if it's going to cause problems for our electric grid, and so we're hamstrung. Other states are going to get that business.
They can go to Northern Virginia, but Northern Virginia is having brownouts because they have so many data centers. You've got to get the right balance there. I think we're going to be able to get a data center there. I want to put together the right proposal. I want them to pay for energy efficiency so we can make our homes use less electricity. We're launching our wind power right down the street in New London. The first turbine, I think the first work starts tomorrow on that. It's pretty expensive, though. I got to make sure electricity is affordable, not just available.
Yeah. What does the governor? What can the governor do to make electricity more affordable and also make sure it's on all the time?
All right, good question. Here, you said, where do I need the national government to step in? I think on energy, we need the national government to step in. I can say, look, I'm Little Connecticut, and I can make a deal with Millstone, and maybe I can get Maura Healey in Massachusetts, and we can do something on wind power together. But the entire New England region has the highest price electricity there is. I need the federal government to step in. When it comes to bringing down transmission from Quebec Hydro, it's tough for a governor to negotiate with four other states. It's a lot better if the feds step in. What is our energy grid going to look like on a national basis? And then let the governors help implement that on a regional basis.
Have you had some of those national conversations?
Yeah, I'm very, very concerned about that. I mean, I can, as a governor, we as a state, we can control our taxes. We can make the investments in social services we think are necessary. We can devote more to higher education. I can do more housing. I don't control my energy future. And that is probably one of the Achilles heels for our state because of the high price of electricity. And everything from AI to advanced manufacturing involves more electricity.
You've said a couple times how you really believe that the Connecticut's economy is going strong. Do you know Fred Karstensen?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So Fred is a UConn economist, longtime contributor to a bunch of things, certainly that I've done over the years. He wrote me and he said, this is a quote. He said that your administration seems stunningly passive in the face of the continuing weakness of the state's economy. And he talked about private sector employment still being at like 1990 levels. He doesn't see Connecticut doing as well economically as neighbors like Rhode Island. You disagree, but the fact of the matter is that we don't have the employment growth that some other states have.
He's partially right on that. If you want to go back 20 years, we were at also-ran, and we were falling behind, and our neighboring states were doing better. Right now, we have the fastest-growing economy in the Northeast by a little bit. But we are the slowest-growing region in the country, the Northeast. So I'm the tallest guy in the pygmy colony. You can debate this both ways. But I think we're making progress, Fred. I think that's the point. We have more people employed, more new business startups, more opportunity for folks who otherwise wouldn't be able to get the job. I mean, when I was graduating from college during the 1970s, it was like a scene from Hunger Games. There was just no jobs out there. Today, I go to downtown New London. I can look at a kid and I can say, I can get you the job you want. I can get you the skills you want. There's a job right here in Connecticut for you. You know, I can tell you, I was just at EB Electric Boat today, and they just hired 6 kids right out of El Grasso Technical High School, right on the spot.
When it comes to people moving into the state, what do you think happened? Is it just because people were moving out of New York and Boston, some of the bigger cities during COVID, and they found bucolic Connecticut a place to call home? Or is there something else to it? Because people have been moving in over the course of the last 5 years or so.
I think it's a couple of things. I think that was part of it. I mean, we kept our parks and beaches open. A lot of people did visit Connecticut. We had more tourists visiting Connecticut during COVID than ever before. You know, who would have thunk it? And a lot of them stayed. A lot of them ended up sending their kids to school. I think remote work is changing the nature of the game. In the old days, the cool kids had to be in Boston or New York, right? You know, New London or Uncasville. I mean, I don't know. But now you can work for Google from Uncasville. And, so I think that's changed the dynamic of what makes Connecticut more appealing. Now, let's face it, we have really good schools, a really great quality of life, and our taxes are now very competitive with our peers. There are a lot of reasons people are moving back.
But we have to keep up on that, right? We have to keep investing in schools. We've got to make sure that people feel like this is a place that is investing in people. And that's the balancing act you have every year, right? Because if people don't think that Connecticut is a state that's going to invest in them or take care of them when they get sick, well, then they can go any place, right?
Well, but I don't think I'd rather be anywhere but Connecticut in terms of those criteria. I mean, I think we have, the best K-12 system in the country. That said, I got a lot of work to do in the cities where some of those kids continue to fall behind. You may not think I'm spending enough money on higher ed, but we have great higher ed. UConn has gone from, an okay school to one of the top 15 public universities in the country. People know it. Graduates all over, high school graduates want to go to UConn, not just from Connecticut, but from all over the country. My job is now stay in Connecticut.
Obviously, people can, not everyone in every job, but people can work a lot more places. That having been said, we heard from a lot of people who wrote in with questions about Shoreline East trains, cuts in funding and services. We've talked a lot over the years, Governor, about public transportation in Fairfield County, but there's a lot of people in this part of the state that feel kind of left out by public transportation investments. What do you say to those people who wish that there was more rail travel available for Eastern Connecticut?
I'd say, we're making, thanks to the Biden administration, to be blunt, the biggest investment in transportation is going to be transformed, really important for a state like ours. In particular, when it comes to Shoreline East, their population was, users was going down dramatically even before COVID. We subsidized it to the tune of about $150 per seat, but I've been very, frank with all the mayors along the way. There's more housing built along the Shoreline East train stations. There'll be more demand and there'll be more rail service.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's a chicken and egg, right? If you don't have housing, you're not going to have people. If you don't have people, you're not going to have housing. What comes first?
I can't subsidize the status quo. We've got to continue to be able to reform and make changes. And right now, I'm prioritizing rail service where there's more demand and I can get a lot faster rail. Waterbury Line is picked up, Metro North is picked up. Here in Southeast Connecticut, we're doing a lot more in terms of micro transit. It's a little like Uber, where we provide it at no cost to people in need so they can get around.
Yeah,
but not always a bus service is the best way to do it.
Sure, but I'm not talking about subsidizing the status quo. We're talking about making transformative, maybe, investments in places that haven't yet seen that type of ridership because there haven't been the places to live near train stations. That's not status quo investment. That's building a new type of Connecticut in this part of the state.
Well, we're building a lot of housing. They built a lot of housing in New London, as I said before. We made sure that Shoreline East tickets can also work on Amtrak. So that connection between New London and New Haven is picking up in a big way. But I'll be blunt, John. You know, my job is sometimes you have to set priorities. Mm-hmm. And there's not many people in state government that set priorities. You know, you can do all the above. Or we can have a, you know, debate. Maybe we do a little more in taxes and spend a little more. I don't think it worked that well for us in the previous 20 years, but those are the type of decisions we can make. Right now, again, I'd say we're making significant, biggest investments in our history. I think they're making a difference, and I think people like what they see.
Speaking of investments, one member wrote in with an idea that you probably never want to hear about again. He writes, why not install electronic tolls? Lower income taxpayers could be given a credit on their tax return from EasyPass data. Stop giving free rides to out-of-staters. Yes, it's the toll booth issue once again, Ned Lamont, but I don't know. It does help pay for stuff, and there are an awful lot of free riders coming through, especially in, you know, just from a couple miles from here.
You may have heard I kind of fell on my pick on that issue my first year.
But you're right.
40% of the tolls will be paid for by out-of-staters. It's not toll booths. It's going to be electronic tolling. But forget it. At this point, we have to think, though, in terms of how we're going to pay for transportation over the next 15 years. And I need legislators to step up and add to that conversation, not just say, I hate tolls. Let's face it, whether you think it's hybrids or EVs, gasoline tax revenues are going to go down, and we have to pay for transportation. I can do it with a sales tax, I can do it with income tax, or I can do it with a user fee. Mm-hmm. But I need the legislature to step in and not simply argue for more resources, but also how we're going to do it.
Are you willing to go back to bat for that? I mean, are you willing to look at that once again, seriously using some political capital to say, yeah, this is something we have to do, because every other state in the Northeast does it?
Not right now, because what we did do was we made the sales tax, more of that go into the transportation fund. Our transportation fund is fully funded. It's fully funded for, I don't know, next 3-4 years. That's a good place to be. And also, having a fully funded transportation fund means that when Joe Biden says we have a deal where we can speed up rail service, it's going to be a $500 million project, but Connecticut, you have to put up $100 million of it, or 20%. We're ready to go. Other states say, I got to go raise the money. We don't have to do it. That's where we're getting more than our fair share of this investment money.
Okay. Let's move on to another question that a member sent in. In Connecticut, thousands of workers have been denied millions of dollars in owed wages by their employers over the past few years. The State Department of Labor has done great work helping them recoup those dollars, but there are fewer investigators, and there's 1,000 complaints outstanding. Is there a way to get money into the budget to help get these workers their money back?
Dante Bartolomeo over in Labor, we've got enforcers to make sure that people who feel like they're being unfairly denied wages, we do it. But I'll push back a little bit, John. We can say the answer to this is more investigators and more people. I've also put a lot of money into IT and technology. We've talked about AI. So I'd like to think about other ways we can address this, not simply adding more people.
This is a case of, like, more people could actually get more work done, though. Sometimes you need people.
Yep, and also technology makes them 3 times more efficient. We're doing both.
I will say that some of my colleagues at the Connecticut Mirror have said that as they go to various state agencies and they put in Freedom of Information Act requests, it's taken so much longer than it used to. And that really is a people power problem, like months and months to get documents that are publicly available documents. I'm sure that you've heard some of these stories. What do you think that is, and what can change at state agencies if we're not going to put more people at the problem, what can change the state agencies to make it more efficient so that people get the stuff they need?
So FOIA is freedom of information. Every email and text and, you know, is all subject to public scrutiny in the name of transparency. So I've added a FOIA, freedom of information people, in every single department because we are getting lots and lots of requests. I'll give you one simple thing that would make it a lot easier. Rather than say, I want to see every single correspondence where the governor discussed the economy, narrow your search, and that makes it a lot easier for us. Because remember, every single discussion where you talk economy, maybe you're talking about people or somebody you didn't hire or a company that was denied, and all that you can't have subject to FOIA or else that person or that company will never do it. So it is fairly time-consuming. If you narrow the search, we can definitely speed up the response.
I'll say I've written some of these in the past and with some pretty narrow searches, and it still takes an awful long time. Yeah. It really does. And sometimes it's just what we're told by state agencies is there's just not enough people to do this work, but it's actually work that's on behalf of the people of the state of Connecticut, right? It's their information. And sometimes that information just isn't transparent enough.
How many governors in this country are subject to FOIA? Me. We had a terrible scandal going back 20 years, and we have the strongest FOIA rules around. We are following those. I'm adding people there. We're responding as quickly as we can. And I do think if the searches are less broad, we can respond a lot more quickly.
Let's get to one more.
Let's have a little fun, John.
Have a little fun. I had some fun. I talked about your grandkid. How much more fun can it be than that? I'm even going to ask you about your belt in a second. One more question that's not fun. Regionalization is a dirty word in Connecticut, this person writes, but avoiding it allows many of our most difficult problems to go unaddressed. How can you open the door to regionalization, which could help Connecticut be a more satisfying place to live for the majority of its inhabitants?
All right, so that was another one I tried to do early on because we have 169 towns. They're all feisty independent. They all have their superintendents and police chief and directors of curriculum. We duplicate a lot of services, and we have very high property taxes. So I said, look, if we could share some of these back office services, if we could share purchasing, if we could share building inspectors, maybe we could bring down property taxes. And you ran into the fact that these towns go back, you know, 100, 200 years. They've been independent. Nobody's going to take away our opportunity to do it our way, even if it costs us a premium. So what did I do? We're adding people to the COGS, which are the regional, county-like government, and saying, look, we're going to have a building inspector. We're going to have an IT professional. We're going to have some people there. Maybe Preston or Montville, you're too small. You don't want to hire that person on a full-time basis, or allow you to contract for that person on a day-to-day basis. That's a softer way of getting to some of the regional efficiencies, which I think are really important. Our property taxes are the killer. It's really regressive. It's very expensive. And you know, you may say, well, Ned, how come the state just doesn't give more money to the cities or more money to education? You know, we've got the highest investments there we have. We also have to do everything I can to help our cities to bring down costs. The other way you do it is we've got more new businesses starting up in our local towns. These are not Facebooks and Googles. These are local businesses, be they restaurants, dry cleaners, ways that people can live and work in their communities. That expands the tax base and brings down costs.
Okay, you wanted a fun question?
Yeah, please.
Are you running for governor again?
Oh, that's really fun. I've made up my mind. I'll tell you what's going through my mind. I just turned 70, so yeah, it makes you think about things a little bit. I love the job. I think the state's doing relatively well. That makes you think, you know, we keep it going. I think we got some good people who are pretty eager, waiting in the wings. And I just don't think I have to decide now. I don't like the politics. I love governing. I can't stand campaigning. And everybody spends all their time campaigning in this state, and I don't. I'm going to defer that decision for a year, and I'll get back to you.
Okay, defer the decision. You seem to be talking like someone who's running for governor again, because I feel like there's some things that you might say or do different, or if you weren't running for governor? I mean, this is something that happens to politicians all the time, right? When they're at the end, they say, you know what the hell? It doesn't matter anymore. I'm not running again, and I can do these five things that I think are really important. Have you given that some thought? Like, maybe you can go out in a blaze of glory and do some really cool stuff.
I think we're doing it right now. I hope we are. I feel sort of liberated. I'm not burdened by, I don't do any polls. I get an opportunity to do what I think is right. People give me a little latitude to push that way. I'm not trimming my sails in any way, if that's what you're suggesting for political purposes. I don't think I usually have, and I'm certainly not now at this age.
Is there something that if you did run again, is there something that you think, yeah, that's the thing I want to accomplish? Like, the thing that when I retire, I want them to write about me in whatever newspaper is still left, because there might not be newspapers left. If you know, what do you want them to write about you that you have done in these last 4 years?
I think we've got a lot of really important initiatives started, and I want to make sure they get over the finish line.
Give me
politics
one.
Is loaded with people that make promises, then they retire in 4 years, you don't know what happened.
Yeah.
I've told you I'm going to take 15 minutes off your commute. I've told you we're expanding daycare and childcare. I've told you we're going to, increase the affordable and supportive housing and workforce housing in all of our cities and bring those cities back to life. To your point, John, these are not four-year projects. These are probably 14-year projects or longer. I want to make sure we're getting off on the right foot. I want to make sure taxpayers know their money is being invested in a way that is making a difference, not just for them, but for your grandchild.
The series that we're doing here in the room is kind of a riff on your favorite song from Hamilton. I actually, when we were thinking about the name for the series, I thought, is this going to be too close to like Ned Lamont's favorite song from Hamilton? And people will think about that. Do you still listen to Hamilton all the time? Is that like what's on your, I don't know, CD player or cassette deck or whatever you listen to?
I was a little obsessed, I got to admit it, for a few years. Less so
like
now.
It.
Which song are you referring to?
It's called, like, literally, In the Room Where It Happens. Yeah, and you talked a lot about In the Room Where It Happens.
Well, it's interesting. We were talking about FOIA before. And In the Room Where It Happened is where Jefferson and Hamilton get together and they make the deal about the a bank that's going to be able to pay the Revolutionary War soldiers, and location of the capital, not in New York, not in Virginia, but in Washington, D.C. And the theme of the song is, no one else was in the room where it happens. And if everybody is in the room, it would have been a lot tougher to make that deal.
Well, there you go.
But I like other songs, too. I love what they say about immigration in that show, and immigrants make it happen. And this has always been a country that treasures its diversity and welcomes immigrants and welcomes folks from around the world. And this is a beacon of hope where people want to come to this country because it's the greatest country on earth. And while we're concerned about the illegal immigration, we got to be strong there. I don't want to forget the meaning of immigration and diversity in this country.
I promised I was going to ask about your belt. Can you stand up so people can see your belt? Have people seen this before? I don't know if you could ask the audience. So I don't know if you can see it.
It's a Grateful Dead belt.
It's a Grateful Dead belt.
It's brought me relatively good luck, so I've worn it for about 6 straight years. Dan Hurley wants me to keep wearing it.
Why are you wearing a Grateful Dead? I mean, like, what made you think one day that's what I'm going to put on as governor?
I'm not a fashionista. My pants were falling down, and I got a belt. But I'll tell you, since then, I get a kick out of it because I have a half dozen people a day give me the secret Grateful Dead handshake and say, what was your favorite concert, dude? So,
and so what was your favorite concert, dude?
I'm afraid it's generally been Bob Marley, Jimi Hendrix, the Rolling Stones, and Bruce Springsteen here a couple days ago. A little less... Bruce, you know what Bruce Springsteen said when he came here, by the way? He was sort of he come here, he says, it's really great, he played right here, and he says, it's great to be here in Uncasville. Where the hell is Uncasville, he goes. he did a really kicking concert, I got to tell you.
But you're not a Grateful Dead fan?
I love the music, I just don't happen to have gone to a concert, which has been aggravating for some of the people that come up to me.
I hadn't sat down with you for a long time. I get the sense that you enjoy this. Do you actually enjoy this most days?
I love it. I mean, I love the state. I love the people. I love what this state stands for. I think it has the best values. It's a place that I'm proud to call home, and I want my kids and grandkids to feel the same way. I feel like it was a state that it lost its way. It was a little down on itself 10, 15 years ago. And if I can play a small role in bringing back the confidence and hope that I think represents the best of Connecticut, thank you. At my age, it's a real honor to have the opportunity to do it.
I want to thank you very much, Ned Lamont, for sitting down with us and being part of this. Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Nice to see everybody.
Thank you so much, folks. I want to say special thanks to our sponsors, the Mohegan Tribe, Connecticut Business and Industry Association, Eversource, Clifton Larson Allen, the Causeway Agency, Express Strategies, Hinckley Allen, and Rothorn Law. We have a lot of sponsors now, Ned, which is a great thing. Thank you to Michael Mandel for helping to coordinate with the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks to Mohegan Sun for helping us host this event. Thanks to all the Mohegan Sun staff. Thank you to the Connecticut Mirror team as well, especially our publisher, Bruce Putterman, and our events coordinator, Brianna Nelson, Gabby DeBenedictis, our manager of audience development, Irene Mackey, Claire Dignan, Chris Nilsson, Elizabeth Hamilton. We hope that you can join us for the third installment of In the Room. It's with Attorney General William Tong. It's on Wednesday, May 29th in Stamford. By going to our events page now, you can stay up to date on more information that will come out soon. We'll see you in Stamford, and we'll see you at the Connecticut Mirror. It's Connecticut Mirror, ctmirror.org. If you haven't yet clicked that little donate button, I encourage you to do so. I've talked to Ned Lamont for years about the importance of nonprofit, nonpartisan media. I worked in public radio for a very long time. I think it's extraordinarily important that we support media. I made a joke about newspapers going away. It's happening everywhere in America, and we'd like to make sure that doesn't happen to the Connecticut Mirror. So please support your local nonprofit, nonpartisan news source. Good night. Thank you.